Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this afternoon is to my right, Justice Sue Walker. To my left, Justice Lee Gabriel. I'm Leanne Dofino. And you are the only case on our 3 o'clock docket. You have our undivided attention. And both sides are ready, then we'll call the case and get started. Okay, Barry.
May it please the court, Barry Green for the appellant defendant. As this court well knows, if an individual is finally convicted for DWI second and commits a new offense of DWI, he finds himself in a very tenuous situation. If he is still on probation for the DWI second, he risks a motion to revoke and being sent up to 1 year in the county jail and a $4,000 fine. Also, because he has twice been finally convicted, he is subject to being prosecuted in the district court for a felony offense of DWI, having two prior convictions, carrying with it a range of 2 to 10 years and up to a $10,000 fine. In this case, Mr. Lundgren pled to DWI second, and then before the expiration of 30 days, was arrested for a new offense of DWI in
seven days
in Tarrant County, Texas. If that offense, alleged offense, I should say, had occurred after the expiration of 30 days from the time he pled on the DWI second, we certainly would not be here. There would be no question that the DWI second had become final, and there would be nothing to argue, nothing to discuss. But I find he comes to me at this point, and realizing that the longstanding law in the state of Texas is that if a case is on appeal, then the probation does not begin until the mandate issues from the Court of Appeals.
Can it begin?
Can it begin?
Can it? If somebody wants to start serving their probation, can they serve it?
The probations obviously do not begin on the 30th day. They begin immediately, which may be more just by tradition than by actual Code of Criminal Procedure. Because the 30 days before it becomes final is, in fact, and of course it's always been the law in the state of Texas. I could have sat back and do nothing. But I find myself in the position that if filing a notice of appeal invokes that law, that his probation had not begun until this court would issue a mandate, I felt absolutely obligated to do so, and I did so. This court did what I expected it to do. I had done that this is outside the record, but forgive me. I'd done that one time before in 2005, where the court did the same thing it did here. Asked for a reason why the appeal should not be dismissed, dismissed the appeal, and issued a mandate. In that case, I was able to negotiate with the district attorney and the county attorney, showing them the applicable law, and was able to resolve it. I was hopeful that the same resolution would occur here. It did not. I suppose that the state is going to argue that there should be some type of exception to that long-standing law of and probation should begin once the mandate issues. This court would certainly have to create one out of whole cloth, which it certainly has the authority to do if it believes that to be the accurate interpretation of the statutes and the case law. And I suspect the argument may be that this court didn't have jurisdiction, and that's something which may be semantic, which I guess is what we deal with mostly in all aspects of criminal law and civil law. This court certainly had the right to accept the appeal and docket it. It certainly had the right to ask for a reason why it should not be dismissed. Certainly had the right to dismiss the appeal and had the right to issue the mandate. The mandate itself says that this appeal will be dismissed. So even though the court did not have jurisdiction, there was an appeal. An appeal that was dismissed, an appeal that was followed by a mandate, which under our law should cause the terms and conditions of probation to then go into effect for the very first time. Jurisdiction has been defined, refers to the power of a court to hear a controversy and make decisions that are legally binding on the parties involved. So the fact that this court, in its mandate, said that it did not have jurisdiction, that does not mean the same thing that there was no appeal. There was one. It was short and it was sweet and it was what I expected it to be, but there was an appeal. And even though, again, I don't want to anticipate what he's going to say, but we've talked about it quite a bit. It's not 33 days. His appeal will begin once the appeal should have begun once the mandate issued. His 2-year probation would then go into effect. He would serve the entire 2 years as mandated. It is not a free 30 days to do whatever you choose. It is somewhat of an anomaly, perhaps, in Texas law that this procedural mechanism does exist, but I would argue that it does.
Someone waives their right to appeal, and the new offense occurs between the time that the probation order is entered and the time that the notice of appeal is given. Your argument is basically, other than he can be prosecuted for the new offense, it's basically that's a freebie for the probation violation, because you later decided to file a notice of appeal knowing that he had no right to appeal. Where is your authority for the contention that the probation didn't start on the day he entered the plea and that the judgment was entered under the circumstances that there was no notice of appeal for a period of time, at least until after the new offense was committed?
Absolutely, and I hate to use words historically, but let me use that word. If it had been a regular trial and the judge had been found guilty and the judge had sentenced him to probation immediately on the same day as the guilty verdict, there's nothing to prohibit a defendant from beginning that probation, but an actual notice of appeal, which has not been waived, to be filed on the 29th or 30th day. And in that situation, the mandate law would kick into effect. And once the mandate comes down, then the probation would begin. Now, has he served 30 days extra in that scenario when he shouldn't have had to? Perhaps. But if the appeal is filed, that's going to change the start date. It does, to a certain extent, extend the probation in that situation, but it would not technically begin and not be subject to any type of violations until the mandate comes down.
That's not our scenario here.
Our scenario is different in that we signed a waiver. I have made no arguments in this court that it was involuntary. I have made no similar arguments at all. Not going to do that. But waiving the right to appeal did this. It prevented this court from resolving any cases on any controversy I might have had on the merits. It could no longer do that. I waived my right to have this court consider an appeal, which I consider significantly different than filing a notice of appeal and having it dismissed and the mandate come down. There are differences. I had no opportunity to argue, to make any points of error before this court, because that is something we bargained away, and we kept our word in that regard.
So are you saying, because by extending out your logic here, everyone who enters a plea of guilty, gets probation, waives their right to appeal, they don't actually start their probation until 30 days after the judgment is entered that says report to the probation officer today?
If no notice of appeal is filed within 30 days, it would be my opinion that the probation began when the judgment was signed. if a notice of appeal is filed within the 30 days, that changes the start date to when the mandate issues.
So any crime they commit in that gap, they are not held accountable for on their probation.
If the notice of appeal is in fact filed, it's not a free 30 days. They're still going to do their entire probation on the back end. It's very similar to the case I cited in the brief where someone is found guilty of a felony conviction and the next day, somehow, some way, ends up in trial on another felony case, and the issue there is whether or not they are probation eligible. In that case, the court said, yes, they are, because that plea they just entered into, 30 days has not yet run, and that case has not yet become final. Very, very similar, only just in a different context. And one thing I don't want to overlook, and I might not have spent enough time on it in my brief, the Ross v. State case in there, out of the Court of Criminal Appeals, got outside the aspect of a waiver and mandates and said in the context of when an appeal is dismissed, they saw no reason why the same logic should not occur, that the probationary term should go into effect once the dismissal came down. This second point of error, oddly, it might be my strongest one, no matter how much I've thought and worked on the first one. When the mandate came down in this case, Judge Cood of the County Court at Law Number 1 signed a post-mandate enforcement of prior judgment of conviction and sentence suspended, and specifically ordered the sentence to commit on June 22nd. That is, once he received the mandate, a new judgment went into the file, specifically ordering the probation to begin, just like it should under, at least in my interpretation, of what the current case law is. That judgment was never challenged by the state. That judgment is in still force and effect in the county clerk's office in Wise County, Texas. It has not been challenged. The last judgment in this case indicates that the probation should have began on June 22nd, 2011, which is a date after the alleged new offense. I struggle with whether or not to almost make that my first point of error, because I think that's an important fact. I've cited some cases which would indicate that the state certainly had the right to challenge that particular judgment. It was not.
Why would it be challenged? Because, I mean, once you gave your notice of appeal, clearly under the law, he was no longer responsible for complying with the terms and conditions of probation until there was a mandate. So if the judge hadn't entered the order once the mandate was returned, then to return him to the conditions of probation, I mean, isn't that what the judge should have done, is sign an order?
Absolutely. And once that post-mandate judgment was signed, the case at that point came into the context of exactly what I thought should occur, that the notice of an appeal should have stopped the terms and conditions of probation, the new start date should be when the mandate is issued, and our judge signed a judgment saying, you know, the terms and conditions now begin since I've now received the mandate.
What you just said is the notice of appeal stopped the terms and conditions of probation. So they started when the judgment was signed, they stopped when you filed the notice of appeal, and they restarted when the judge signed that order. Those are what you just said. That's what you just said.
And that I would certainly say at this point say I misspoke. The notice of appeal changes the effective start date of the terms and conditions of probation.
According to the judgment of the trial court.
Yes, ma'am.
Is that what you're saying?
Any other questions? I'll waive the rest of my time. Right, thank you.
Good afternoon. May I please court? James Stanton, Wise County Attorney. I think there's an important distinction to be made here. The cases that Mr. Green cites for the general proposition that somebody's probation conditions do not start until a mandate has been issued, if you look at those cases, I believe you'll find that most all of them, and I think actually all of them that are cited here, are either a result of a jury verdict, a judge verdict, or a verdict where there's been no waiver. I think the general rule does apply to that. If you're an individual and you're found guilty of a crime, and I think at least in our court, our judge says something along the nature of your right to appeal attaches at this time. It's different. This is a distinction between simply having a jury verdict and then appealing a jury verdict on it. This case here is different than the cases that Mr. Green cites in his brief. Case here, we have a full and extensive waiver, waiving all rights of appeal in this particular case. And I think that's an important distinction to be made than the versus the original rule. This case is different. It is different because it's not from a jury verdict. If this had been a jury verdict, well, then we wouldn't be here today.
Y'all object to the judgment that said probation starts today?
The initial judgment
or the
second judgment? No, we did not.
Which judgment do we look at?
The judgment that we should look at, and this is kind of a two-piece deal here. The judges, the second judgment that the judge entered simply changed the date the probation condition started. Now, that's common practice and procedure in our court to let the defendant know, hey, you need to go start your probation. You know, and most of the time, I don't even know that that's been entered, to be quite honest with you. I mean, that just, the judge just does that as a matter of course, just to kind of alert the defendant, hey, we've got a mandate, hey, go to probation. And that's really what happened in this particular case. No, I did not object to that. I didn't appeal that. But again, I think that the judgment that the judge entered in and of itself, I don't think it changes what happened in the beginning. I think the judge entered a nunc order simply changing the time in which probation starts. It did not change the date of the judgment. It did not change the date of the conviction.
Well, then if the judge changed the date the probation started, was he on probation or was he not on probation when he was rearrested?
I believe that what the judge did here entering the nunc order probably wasn't necessary. And in fact, based on what happened in this case, you know, I don't have any direct case law. This is kind of an area of first impression. I don't have anything on it. I don't have a lot on this. But I'll be honest with you. I feel like the judge's nunc order shouldn't have been entered. And I've argued here that it should be probably void in and of itself simply because it's seeking to change something other than more of a clerical error. It's restarting probation conditions and everything else. I don't really think it's necessary. But I think that kind of belies the point of the very beginning of where this all started. Where this all started is we have an extensive waiver in this particular case wherein Mr. Green's client signed it. Mr. Green signed it. Everybody was in agreement such that we would avoid trial, such that we would go on probation, such that we would have all of that, such that we would agree to do all of this. However, when something else, the new allegations came to light, a new DWI in Tarrant County, now we're seeking to avoid the consequences of your plea and the waiver at a later date. And I don't think that's what the law contemplates. I think fundamentally in Texas, when two parties make a deal and two parties have an accord, that should remain in place. When Mr. Green and his client waive those rights of appeal, I believe in Texas that means something. I believe it means that you do not have a right of appeal. It doesn't mean that you can appeal in the 30 days if you do something wrong to avoid the consequences of your appeal, of your plea.
Frankly, I'm concerned about that judgment that told him he hadn't been on probation during that period of time when he got his new arrest, and
well,
that
I don't know that it's
starting
actually
fresh.
Well, I don't know that. I think that judgment, in and of itself, like I said, I've argued that judgment itself is void, that it shouldn't exist because this court dismissed the initial case for want of jurisdiction. Not that dismissed it based upon some type of factual or legal issue, but simply said we don't have jurisdiction to hear this based on the waiver and so on and so forth. So, you know, as far as that judgment, I can't fix that judgment. It is what it is. The judge entered it. That is a common practice in the court. But to look at it again in hindsight, I think it's probably improper to be entered in the first place.
Did that judgment say you weren't on probation?
No, it did not.
It just says it's starting again.
It changed. We haven't.
Starting.
Pardon me. The initial judgment had a commencement date. I think it's part of the record. You can look at it. It's got the judgment date on the left. And it says commencement date on the right, and it just changed the probation commencement date to a different date to reflect the mandate of this court dismissing the appeal without jurisdiction. That was the only thing that it changed. The rest of the things are in place. So again, I think my first point is that this is a different case where other than a jury verdict. Had we had a jury verdict, it would be completely different. Had Mr. Green alleged some type of involuntariness, had Mr. Green alleged some type of possible Padilla concerns, I think it would be a different situation. But that's not what happened here. And I think that's important to note. So I think that, again, the main point that I have is that we entered into a waiver, and I believe that's extremely important, and I believe that when you do that and you've indicated that using the code when you waive those rights just to simply avoid the consequences is just wrong. I don't know how anybody else to say it. I don't believe that's the way the law contemplates. I understand how the law works if you have a jury verdict, and I understand that you didn't issue a waiver, but I think it's different. Now, I have not been able to locate any cases directly on point on this particular specific issue where we have a post-waiver appeal. I've not been able to locate one. I haven't seen one from him either. But we have a true current law. There are some past cases where people had some waivers, but I'm talking the current waiver rules what we have, where people issue a certificate of non-appealability and various other things. There isn't a case out there. So I think that's important to note. And I think it does, as the Justice mentioned, this individual was on probation for that 7 days. He committed a new offense while he was on probation. And then subsequently after that, there was a notice of appeal which attempted to stay that probation for a certain amount of time. My argument still stands that basically he was on probation. He committed an offense while he was on probation, and he should be held accountable for it. Now, I can't answer about our county court at law judge in the judgment. I'm going to have to leave that one up to the court because I don't have any cases directly on point one way or the other. But I think that when the court looks at this, I think that and I will argue that it does give a defendant a freebie. And I think that's important to note, because if we can simply avoid trial, we can avoid the possibilities of that, get our plea, get our probation, avoid all that, and then just simply say, it was a waiver. I got what I wanted. But now I did something else wrong. I don't want to face the consequences of it. I don't think that's what our law implies. I don't think that's what is right under the law. So a couple of other points here. We talked about, Ms. Green talked about jurisdiction a little bit, and I may have put this in my brief. This court always has the ability to determine whether or not it has jurisdiction, always has the jurisdiction to determine whether or not it has jurisdiction. I know that sounds profound. And in this case, I don't think that when the court said we don't have jurisdiction to hear this, I don't think that means that you simply get to avoid the consequences of the waiver. The waiver's there for a reason. And so when this court comes in and says, we don't have jurisdiction, I think that's important. And that was important to me, is that not only did you not have the right to be here, we're kicking your case because you don't have the right to be here. You don't have the right to come in here and appeal because you signed a waiver with counsel and you haven't alleged anything that gave us the ability to be here. You haven't given us the ability to do that. So I think that's kind of abusing the system in that respect.
I have a question about the motion for new trial.
Yes, ma'am.
What happened to that?
The motion for new trial was denied by the county court at law judge.
Is there a hearing?
I think we heard that possibly during, at the same time we heard the motion to quash. I believe those were heard simultaneously. If the judge didn't deny it, just outright. I know we had several hearings. We had hearings on the initial appeal, and then we had. Then we had a secondary motion to quash hearing on the motion for the revocation, and then we had the revocation trial.
And at the time of the hearing on the motion for new trial, the trial judge was aware of the new offense or not? Did it come up in the record?
I don't believe that the new offense came up on the record at the time the judge entertained the motion for new trial. I feel fairly confident about that. I think it, I don't know that we actually had a full-blown hearing on the motion for a new trial. I know that we had a full-blown hearing on the motion to quash, and if we heard them both at the same time, obviously the judge would have information on that. But like I said, I'm not positive. I can't give you an absolute answer. I'd like to.
I would like you to.
I would love to. I'll do my best for you, but we had quite a few extensive hearings in this case. I mean, it's for a misdemeanor case, the record is fairly thick. That's pretty much all that I have. I'll leave it to the court at this point. Thank you.
Thanks. Barry, add anything?
If my memory serves me correctly, I believe the motion for a new trial was overruled by operational law. I don't think I pursued that to a full hearing, just allowed it to be overruled as an operational law.
Okay.
Going back to the second judgment, just to clear up one thing in the record, because I think there is some confusion when the briefs are read. The subsequent judgment post-mandate, it was followed up a day or two later with a nunk-pro-tunk judgment, but it was just to clarify because the fine had been truncated. So when you see the words nunk-pro-tunk, that was just to clarify that particular aspect of it. When that judgment was signed, it modified a prior judgment, in the very least. Article 44.01 of the Code of Criminal Procedure gives the state a limited right of appeal. They certainly could have issued an appeal at that time, filed a notice of appeal because the judgment had been modified. I cited to a Gutierrez case where a visiting judge came in several months after the fact in a state jail sentencing case and decided to slice the sentence by a few months. The state did appeal that, and the issue on appeal was whether or not that was a modification of a judgment. They said absolutely, and that was the appropriate vehicle to try and overturn that judgment as opposed to allowing it to go final. Let me finish with this. I don't come with the most sympathetic facts with Mr. Lundgren. That is quite obvious. But he is very much in the same position as a man on trial for a DWI second who is found guilty by a jury, and if we elected judge sentencing, the judge would, and hopefully the judge would give probation. In that scenario, I may have turned to Mr. Lundgren and said, we had a fair trial, there was no error, the sentence is fair, we'll forego our right to appeal, good luck, and go on about your way. And then 7 days, 10 days, 14 or 15 days later, he goes and commits a new offense. In that scenario, where the waiver is not involved at all, I would have the absolute right to file a notice of appeal, and I don't think there would be any question among any of us, hopefully, that in that scenario, the probation would not begin with a new effective date until that appeal is pursued, a judgment issued, and a mandate issued. Mr. Lundgren finds himself in a very similar situation as I suppose thousands, tens of thousands of defendants in the state of Texas. He is just one which managed to provide us with a case which is unique on its facts and to explore this particular aspect of the law. If our waiver of appeal does not affect or change the standard line of cases which says the probation does not begin until a mandate is issued, then our motion to quash should have been granted. Regardless of that, the Ross case says that if appeal is dismissed, that should be the effective date. And in that regard, the motion to quash should have been granted. And lastly, but perhaps I should have used firstly, there is a final judgment on file in Tarrant County which has Mr. Lundgren on probation for 2 years, the maximum amount of time he could possibly have got. And the judge says it was to begin on June 22nd of 2011, which is a date prior to any of the offenses alleged in the motion to suppress, revoke his probation. And because of that, the legal effective date of his probation did not begin until after those alleged offenses, alleged violations were committed. And we'd ask this court to rule that the trial court should have granted the motion to quash.
Let me ask you this question, and James, you want to chime away. There's been some case law that's come down. Now, only the defendant can file a motion for new trial. The state cannot file a motion for new trial. A judge cannot grant a motion for new trial on the judge's own motion. But there's some case law that's come down that says a judge can sentence a defendant. The sentence begins to run. The trial's over when the sentence is pronounced in open court with the defendant present. But then there's some case law of the Court of Criminal Appeals that says, but then the judge can, for whatever reason, change the judge's mind, call the defendant back to court, and change the sentence without a motion for new trial, and that's okay. You know the line of cases I'm talking about?
I would love to say yes, Judge. It rings the Vegas bell, but I cannot.
Okay. Well,
recently at least.
I was hoping that you were familiar with that line of cases because, and they've pretty well said, well, okay, well, if it's before court is over that day, then the judge can change the judge's mind. But then we've got the line of cases that says the sentence really isn't imposed until mandate issues. Does that mean that a trial judge can change his or her mind any time then between pronouncing sentence in open court and when the mandate issues?
I would.
How far are we going to go down that slippery slope?
If that particular case, I would. And once again, it would appear that if no appeal is taken, it would be 30 days when plenary jurisdiction is left. If an appeal was taken, it would be the day the notice of appeal was filed. But that would be the best speculation I would have.
What do you think, James? Mm-hmm.
In a case where somebody has actually signed the case. And I keep coming back to that.
Well, both of these are judge sentencing.
Yeah, judge sentencing.
Because you can't change what a jury does.
I would say that the traditional rule would apply, that you have all your appellate period and plenary period and what have you. But I don't know that the judge could just simply change it. So I'm 27 and a half.
I don't have a clue where this is going because I was shocked when a judge could call somebody back out of jail, back to the courtroom. So
I know that it doesn't happen in our court. And Mr. Green and I practice very frequently. It doesn't happen to us yet. So if it does, if it does,
you'd expect him to cause a lot of trouble.
Yes.
Well, we appreciate your argument. Your case is submitted. I wish you'd brought us something a little easier. Thank you for coming all the way to Fort Worth.
It's interesting.
But it's very interesting. Yes, it ends our day today on a high note of interest. So we appreciate it. And